From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. The president will campaign in Pennsylvania today after a notable weekend in which he threatened Iran, mocked Joe Biden, and distanced himself from some of the most controversial provisions in recent state abortion laws. Meanwhile, Republicans have been coming out against one of their own, fellow Congressman Justin Amash, who said that after reading the full Mueller report, he thinks the president committed impeachable offenses. NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson joins us now. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Peter.
Hey, so let's start with Iran. Here's the president speaking to Fox News on Sunday.
I don't want to fight, but you do have situations like Iran. You can't let them have nuclear weapons. You just can't let that happen.
The president also tweeted yesterday that if Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again, he said. So what's going on here, Mara? Because just a few days ago, it seemed like this situation was starting to de-escalate.
Well, it really is whiplash because you're right. Just days ago, the president said, I'm sure Iran will want to talk soon. And he was reported to have told his generals he didn't want to go to war with Iran. But it's very confusing because you've got Trump sounding like he just wants to make a better deal. You've got Bolton, his national security advisor, John Bolton, and his secretary of state, Mike Pompeo, saying that they think that the increased pressure on Iran will lead to regime change. So it's very confusing. It's similar to North Korea. Remember, Donald Trump went from fire and fury to love letters.
Right.
To Kim. So it's very, very confusing. And people are asking, is there a cohesive, coherent strategy?
Right. Or is that the strategy? Confusion.
Well, I don't think that the confusion is the purposeful strategy, although Donald Trump has tweeted, quote, at least Iran doesn't know what to think.
Yeah.
And that might be a good thing. But the problem is that a lot of people in the Middle East don't know what to think. And that's a bad thing.
That could be dangerous.
Because if you don't have coherence, events can spiral out of control and it can lead to miscalculations, which can lead to war.
On another tough topic, the president warned that those who oppose abortion could lose ground if they do not stay united. On the other hand, he also said this weekend, I am strongly pro-life with three exceptions, rape, incest, and protecting the life of the mother, which is at odds with that bill that we saw last week in Alabama. What's the president trying to do there, do you think?
Well, this is really interesting. It sounds like he is edging himself away from the kind of tip of the spear of these state laws that are being passed to challenge Roe versus Wade. The state laws in Georgia would not allow the Alabama law
right.
only allows an exception when the mother's life is in danger. But Georgia goes even further. So is he trying to stake out a middle position? Because even though evangelicals and the pro-life forces were one of the most important parts of the president's base, they're very energized. They see their, you know, decades long goal in reach undermining Roe. But on the other hand, it can also energize the other side if these state laws on abortion look too extreme.
Well, exactly. Democratic candidates have been campaigning explicitly on protecting abortion rights. How is that issue just suddenly revamped and morphed the primary race?
I don't think it's really morphed the primary race. Every Democrat is for reproductive rights. But the big question is, how are they going to deal with this false charge from the president and other Republicans that Democrats are for infanticide, ripping the baby from the mother's womb and killing it? That's what you hear the president saying. I think that Democrats were surprised at how much traction this false charge got. But I think Democrats have to decide how they want to talk about abortion. Remember, Bill Clinton came up with that famous formulation, safe, legal, and rare, which is kind of where most of the country is. Most voters are willing to have some restrictions on abortion, but they want it to be legal.
Okay. There's also Congressman Justin Amash, who said the president committed impeachable offenses and that his actions qualify as obstruction of justice. Now, his fellow Republicans did not like this, even Mitt Romney, who said that he was troubled by the president's behavior, as described in the Mueller report. Here is Romney on CNN's State of the Union yesterday.
Justin Amash has reached a different conclusion than I have. I respect him. I think it's a courageous statement. But I believe that to make a case for obstruction of justice, you just don't have the elements that are evidenced in this document.
So how far out on his own is Justin Amash?
I think right now he's a party of one. The president tweeted about him, called him a loser. Other Republicans have attacked him. But I thought that statement from Mitt Romney was pretty interesting. I respect him. I think it's a courageous statement.
Mm-hmm.
Just Mitt Romney isn't just ready yet to be that courageous, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think that the fact is he's the first Republican who has said that Trump's actions reach the level of impeachment. And that's important. It's not just Democrats anymore. Whether any Republicans will join him as time goes on, we don't know yet.
Okay. The president is also having a rally today in Pennsylvania. This is a state, a very important state that he won narrowly in 2016. It's also, you know, Joe Biden territory. So what do you read into that?
Well, I think that Pennsylvania is extremely important for both parties. The president is worried about his reelection. He's underwater in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Those are the three states that he kind of took away from Democrats and won the White House with. The president could afford to lose Michigan and Wisconsin, but he cannot win reelection without Pennsylvania. And what's really interesting to me is you heard White House officials saying, the only candidate we worry about is Joe Biden, but he'll never be able to get the nomination.
Yeah.
Then the formulation switched to, oh, whoever wins the nomination, we can define as a socialist. Now it's Donald Trump tweeting sleepy, creepy Joe. So he's clearly worried about Biden. He's worried about the Midwest.
Yep.
That is where he had the biggest drop off. That's where the Republicans had the biggest drop off in 2018.
All right. NPR's Mara Liasson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the Supreme Court will soon rule on whether the 2020 census can include a question about citizenship. If it can, some states are at risk of losing federal dollars with an undercount. Arizona, for instance, has a lot of undocumented immigrants who are unlikely to respond to a citizenship question. Matthew Casey of KJZZ in Phoenix reports on what could be a $1 billion problem for that city.
He's going to throw it to you.
Hi.
Children play with a big rubber ball on the playground at a Head Start preschool. The program is a relic of the war on poverty, but being poor isn't the only disadvantage for these kids.
I had to survive for my kids on my own, which meant I had to leave them with strangers before I knew about the program.
Kimberly Olivas is the daughter of undocumented immigrants. She grew up in a violent home and was homeless by 17. Now both of her kids are in the Head Start program, and frankly, they're lucky. Phoenix can only take about a quarter of the children who could qualify. If that number is to grow, or at least stay the same, it will depend on the 2020 census. The city needs everyone to be counted, but that's not always easy. Olivas remembers about 10 years ago, her parents hid in their home.
Because they thought that they can get in trouble, you know, just the fear of deportation. So when the census would come around, they would not open the door.
The number of non-citizens living in Phoenix has dropped since the last census to about 210,000 today. Officials say, if counted, they're worth more than $1 billion in funding to the city over the next decade. The money isn't just for educational programs. It also goes to services like roads, police, and fire, says Albert Santana, Phoenix's census director.
It's at the core of the quality of life of why people want to live in your city.
The Supreme Court recently heard arguments for and against a question the Trump administration wants to place on the 2020 census. The question would ask, quote, is this person a citizen of the United States? If the high court allows it, Phoenix would have less than a year to convince undocumented people not to fear outing themselves to the federal government.
We are focused on counting everyone living in our city. We're not differentiating between resident, non-resident, citizen. We don't care about the category.
Santana points out that the census is confidential, even if there is a citizenship question. But he says the city can't persuade people on its own.
We know that as a government, we cannot be the be-all, end-all to carry this heavy lift. This is truly an all-hands-on-deck effort.
Phoenix's so-called Complete Count Committee has been meeting for months to strategize how to get everyone to take part in the 2020 census. Santana says community outreach will likely start late this summer. Vidi Hernandez, a committee member, says it's been held up by the court battle over the citizenship question.
It seems like we're a little bit behind because what we're trying to build between now and the census is trust.
Hernandez says she was undocumented during the last census, and her family was not counted. Now she has to figure out how to convince people to do something she didn't do.
Yeah, I mean, well, we're actually not ready for that, right? I think there has been a lack of investment to truly get to the root of how we're going to convince people.
Hernandez says the city might help persuade undocumented people to be counted if it commits to using census money to benefit the neighborhoods where they live and invite people to serve on the Complete Count Committee.
There should be undocumented people in that committee.
The Maryvale Community Center might be a good place to recruit them. It offers services that depend on census money, like after-school programs and swim lessons. Phoenix's census coordinator showed me around. On the way out, we bumped into Kimberly Olivas and her two kids in that Head Start program.
Right now he's doing T-ball, and they're both in gymnastics, and she's doing ballet.
Olivas doesn't have a job, but is headed back to school to study nursing. She credits Head Start with giving her family a better life.
I'm so excited for my children to have the things that I didn't have growing up.
Olivas remembers her stepfather was so afraid of immigration authorities that her family never left a four-mile radius. That was before President Donald Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration and before the legal battle over whether to ask about citizenship on the census. The Supreme Court is expected to rule by late June on whether or not the controversial question will be on the census form. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Casey in Phoenix.
The backbone of a free society is a fair judicial system, but according to the National Registry of Exonerations, there have been almost 2,500 wrongful convictions since 1989, and organizations like the Innocence Project are devoted to overturning them. Well, today, a young man who did it himself, now 36-year-old Hassan Bennett of Philadelphia, spent 13 years of a mandatory life sentence in prison, convicted of masterminding a second-degree murder. He just represented himself in a retrial and won. We want to hear how that feels, but first, what happened? Hassan, welcome.
Welcome.
That was some serious business. You were convicted of masterminding the plot to kill 19-year-old Devin English after losing $20 to him in a dice game. That was the claim. There were two other teens. Corey Ford was shot. Lamont Dade arrested. He pled guilty and was sentenced, but in their statements to a homicide detective, they identified you. Now, we're going to unravel that, as you did in court. But at this time, as this is all happening and you're being accused, and by the way, you also had proof you were somewhere else at the time, that must have been crazy-making.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
I mean, how'd that feel? These are friends of yours saying you did it?
What? Well, one of them was a friend of mine, and when I found out that he was saying I did it, I just felt like, why? I didn't understand why he would finger me for the incident. It was kind of like I was hurt.
Yeah.
I felt betrayed. I felt crushed because I had love for this guy.
Well, and also, you had phone records showing that you were on the phone at the time with someone else. There were witnesses to that. What happened? Your lawyer didn't submit those?
No, my lawyer didn't submit anything. After trial, I just looked at his transcripts, the notes of testimony, and realized his whole game plan was the witnesses had lied once. They lied twice. You can't believe them.
Oh, even though there were phone records showing you were on the phone somewhere else with someone else.
And he had the phone records. The phone records were found in his file.
Yeah. It's got to be head spinning that you're convicted and sent away.
Yes. It's like, I often tell people, it's like drowning. It's like being pushed off a cruise and you're drowning. You're in a total panic.
So before you decided to represent yourself, you had a lawyer that was obviously ineffective. When did you decide, I'm going to go for these appeals and I'm going to represent myself?
Well, in 2013, my lawyer was just sitting on my case. He wasn't doing anything. So I filed a motion to withdraw counsel and represent myself.
What did people tell you, by the way? What did people say? I mean, that's rare.
They said, no, you're going to mess it up. They're not going to respect you. You don't know the law. You're going to mess it up. If you stay there, you're going to just stay in jail. And right then, I was like, I have to represent myself. No one's going to fight for me like I'm going to fight for myself. No one's going to talk for me as like I'm going to talk for myself. No one's going to study this case as hard as I am for myself.
You first represented yourself in your third trial last September. Hung jury, all but one juror found you innocent. And people at the time, other jurors said, oh, this is going to crush this guy. Why didn't it? Why didn't you quit then?
Well, at first, when I found it was a mistrial, I felt defeated. But when the papers came out and told me it was 11-1 and I saw the comments the jurors were making and how they felt about my representation as well as the case, I thought it was like I was being praised, you should say. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I am headed somewhere.
I'm on to something, because these jurors in your third trial were praising you for the representation you did. Well, now you throw yourself into learning about the law in earnest. What did you do? How did you prepare?
Well, I would read. I would read day and night. I would read until 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd go to sleep. They'd wake me up at 6 o'clock and I prepare to go to the law library. Everything would be about law. I would only watch TV shows like 60 Minutes, 48 Hours, 2020, How to Get Away with Murder, Vindicated, Death Row Stories. I would only, Forensic Files. I would only watch TV about law. If you wasn't talking about law, I didn't want to be around you. I would get in arguments with everybody. I would read books called The Art of Argument, and I would just try the tactics of argument with basic people, with the COs, with anybody I could to try to prepare me to go to trial, to try to prepare me to go to my evidentiary hearing.
There was an older inmate who helped you, we understand, Brother Mookie?
Yeah, Brother Mook. Yep, Richard Wilson. He sat me down, and we was in the cell together, and we began to have legal conversations. One time, I wrote a petition out. I typed it out, and I asked him, yo, could you review this petition? And he said, I'll review this petition if you read this book. And the book was called Perfecting Brief Writing. So I read the beginning, I read a little bit of the middle, and I read the end. I told him I finished after like 2 days. He looked at the petition, and then he just ripped it up. He ripped up my petition. So I'm like, yo, what'd you rip up my petition? And he said, you didn't read the book. I told you read the book. You didn't read the book. So I'm like, how you know I didn't read the book? He said, read the book and you'll figure out how. Once I read the book, I realized there was a format of brief writing called IRAC, Issue, Rule, Argument, Conclusion. And that's how he knew I didn't read the book. But once I read the book, I wrote my petition. I didn't need him to help me, because he gave me tough love. He made me find it myself.
Well, and then you took it with you to your fourth trial last month. After the hung jury. Now, let's pick up your story, because we said that there were two young men, one a friend, who testified against you. They fingered you in their statements to a homicide detective. That homicide detective was James Pitts. Both those young men recanted and said that Detective James Pitts actually coerced them. It turns out that James Pitts has been assigned desk duty because of a number of different cases in which he's been not just accused, but it's been proven that he coerced testimony. So in your fourth trial, let's go first to you bring those two young men into the courtroom to cross-examine them about their statements against you. Was that hard to face these two young men?
No, when I decided to represent myself, I decided early that I would have to separate myself from the case. So I would have to look at this case as if I'm not defending myself, I'm defending a defendant. So I would often call myself the defendant to separate myself from these guys. So as the prosecution called them, I just listened to what the prosecution said, took notes. I had already had pre-drafted questions for them and pre-drafted answers that I want from other testimony. So I just stuck to the game plan and question them in the angle that I needed to question them.
So both these young men recant, say, you know, we were forced to say this, Hassan Bennett was not there, was not involved. Then you put Detective James Pitts on the stand. How did you address him? This is somebody, again, who is on desk duty because of being accused of coercing witnesses.
Well, I had known that he had cost the city over $3 million for beating up witnesses. I had studied those cases. I had reviewed his answers. I knew how he tried to dance around questions. And he's real tricky. He's like a fox. So even before putting Detective Pitts on the stand, I had questioned cops, well, other detectives that the prosecution put on the stand. And all those detectives said that Detective Pitts was nowhere near the witnesses. They said they interviewed all the witnesses. The witnesses blamed Detective Pitts, and the detective tried to exclude Detective Pitts to say the witnesses were lying. So when I called Detective Pitts on the stand, one of my main angles was to show he had contact with the witnesses. And he admitted to having contact with those witnesses, despite what the detective said. So they crossed each other. They banged each other in the head. I had also known that when I asked Detective Pitts why the witness was down there so long, I knew he would color it as if he was trying to convince the witnesses That's the word he uses, convince. So all I had to do was show how long the witnesses were down there. They were down there. You keep a gunshot victim down there, down homicide, locked in a room for over 10 and a half hours. And you say you don't remember what you did to him. I knew the jury wouldn't believe that, especially after every witness, at least four witnesses, claimed that he did some type of misconduct.
Look, Hassan, you wore your prison uniform against all advice.
Yes.
You compared yourself to a Sesame Street character.
Yeah.
Oscar the Grouch.
Yeah. See, the judge in trials instruct the juries that you can use your common sense and experience to review the evidence. So when I spoke to the jury, I told them I learned common sense as early as Sesame Street. I used to watch Sesame Street, and they would begin it with a song, and it would say, one of these things just doesn't belong here. One of these things aren't quite the same. Which one of these things just doesn't belong here? Now it's time to play our game. It's time to play our game. And in the segment, they would start off, and they may show an apple. Then they'll show a peach. Then they'll show an orange. Then the last thing they'll show is Oscar the Grouch. And they'll ask you which one of these things don't belong. Now, common sense tells us Oscar the Grouch doesn't belong. But I told them the prosecution was trying to urge them that Oscar the Grouch belonged because Oscar the Grouch is outside all day. Oscar the Grouch has a smart mouth. Oscar the Grouch, he speaks his mind openly. He will bang his trash lid on you if he doesn't like what you're talking about. He's the Grouch. So because Oscar the Grouch isn't the favorite person in Sesame Street, if something was to happen in Sesame Street, the first person they'll blame is Oscar the Grouch. I didn't belong in that case, but since I had a smart mouth, I talked back to the cops. I challenged them when I felt they did something wrong. They fingered me for that case. Because I wouldn't help them in other investigations, they fingered me for that case.
That's Hassan Bennett, who just represented himself after 13 years in prison, proving he didn't mastermind a murder. And he's well aware he's not the only victim of flawed justice here.
It's getting lost that a person died in this. I know people praise me. Oh, you did it, you did it, you learned the law, but somebody died in this manner.
Here and Now and the following message is supported by Daily Harvest. Daily Harvest delivers carefully sourced, chef-crafted smoothies, soups, harvest bowls, overnight oats, and more, all built on fruits and vegetables. Each single serving cup can be prepared in minutes. Daily Harvest is designed for convenience, so you can load up on fruits and vegetables first thing in the morning, before bed, and anytime in between. Learn more about Daily Harvest and get 3 free cups in your first box at dailyharvest.com/now.
Morehouse College graduates got a welcome surprise yesterday when their commencement speaker, billionaire Robert F. Smith, announced that he and his family would pay off the student loan debt of the entire graduating class. Cheers of joy erupted on the Atlanta campus. But the reality is that around the country, many more students will be starting off their adult lives with huge student loan debt and little knowledge of how to deal with it. Jill Schlesinger joins us now with some financial advice for those new graduates. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So what is the first thing that new graduates who did not get their student debt forgiven yesterday that they need to do when they graduate? What's the first thing?
Whenever I talk about this, I feel like people are rolling their eyes. So pay attention. Just track your money. No austere budget. But how much are you making? How much are you spending? And this is going to help you address all aspects of your financial life. In fact, I would say that this is probably the most important and the core concept for any financial planning goal that you have in mind.
Right.
Obviously, if you don't know how much is coming in and going out, you cannot make an informed decision.
Sure. So college graduates are leaving school with student loan debt at this time of year, and then they're going to have to start paying. So talk about that, how you can create a reasonable payment plan without just putting it all on your credit card.
Well, I think that there are a few things. Number one is once you've tracked your money and you plug in that minimum amount, because every loan is going to have some minimum amount that you need to pay, but you don't want to do the minimum. You want to do way more than the minimum. Mm-hmm. And the process of tracking the money is a way to identify how much more can I use of my cash flow to help pay down this debt. And you're going to create a list of each loan. And if you have credit cards, if you have an auto loan, put that all in there, lender details, all the interest rates, and then work your way and say, if I've got a 7% loan, I'm going to try to put much more down on that note than perhaps the one that's a 3% loan. And you're going to very methodically work your way through. Don't look at this as the big, huge number, just a little bit more every month. That's how the most successful payoff plans actually go down. They don't go down with someone just magically waving a wand, although that would be nice.
Yeah.
It's you putting a little bit more down on that higher interest debt.
The tricky thing is you also should start saving, right? Because a lot of people probably put that off.
Yeah, I know this is so hard. This is sort of becoming a financial grown-up, right? Because what happens is you've got three main goals. You want to reduce that debt, right? But you also do want some sort of cash reserve fund, 6 to 12 months of your living expenses. And you want to start putting – yeah, 6 to 12 months, because if you lose your job, it takes some time to get yourself back on your feet.
Yeah.
And you want to try to maximize your retirement contributions. A lot of people say to me, which comes first? It's kind of yes. You have to do all three. If you've got a matching component from your employer, try to put as much money into that plan that gets you the match. But even if it's just 1% a year, just to start that habit, it's so important. But those are your big three.
Now, talking about money could start long before people leave the nest, but that's not always possible because a lot of times adults don't feel like they have the tools to teach their kids about money. Just very quickly, Jill, what about that? Maybe should we be teaching this earlier?
Well, absolutely. In fact, we really would love to start having these kinds of conversations with your kids when they're in high school. I know that it's too late for some, but communicating this and also explaining to kids, this is what it will mean to take on this debt for your college. This is how it could impact you.
Yeah.
This could be the difference between living home and living on your own.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thanks so much.
Take care.
You may have seen the 2015 blockbuster HBO documentary, The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. It told the story of the New York real estate heir with a lot of missing or murdered people in his past. His first wife, Kathleen, his neighbor, Morris Black, his best friend, Susan Berman. Well, Durst had already admitted to killing Morris Black. He said it was in self-defense, and he was acquitted of that. But in the fifth segment of the HBO film, The Jinx director Andrew Jarecki presents Durst with an envelope and anonymous letter that was sent to police telling them the location of Susan Berman's body. The handwriting matches another envelope Durst had addressed, and on both, the word Beverly is misspelled in the same way. Durst was arrested in connection with Berman's murder a few days later. And then on the sixth and final part of the series, he seems to confess. He leaves the interview, walks off to the bathroom, still mic'd, and mutters to himself. Listen closely.
What the hell did I do? Killed them all. Of course.
What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. Confession, right? The show had huge ratings. It won two Emmys and a Peabody. Durst's trial is set to begin soon. But the HBO film may be on trial as well, because it turns out those two seemingly incriminating lines were edited out of context by the filmmakers. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik is here. And David, people thought this was a confession.
Right. It seemed as though you had a true crime series ending with a denouement that for once neatly wrapped things up. If you think of the frustration people had listening to the podcast Serial, they wanted the murder mystery resolved. Here was the team that brought you The Jinx about Robert Durst saying, we've got it resolved in his own words. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. We now know that that's not the sequence in which he said those words. You know, he was shown going into a bathroom in this hotel suite where they'd been interviewing him for a second sit down with this seemingly very damning evidence. And this evidence does seem damning. As you say, the writing seems to match his writing on that envelope that had alerted authorities to where they could find Susan Berman's body. And in fact, Beverly Hills was misspelled Beverly, L-E-Y, both in the way he writes it and in the way this anonymous note was written. Okay, it suggests that he knows the body. And then it seems as though he's asking the question, what the hell did I do? And answers it, killed them all, of course. That's not how the transcript shows. The transcript shows him saying, and if you'll indulge me, he says, I don't know what's in the house. Oh, I want this, according to the transcript submitted as part of the evidence. And then he said, killed them all, of course. And then he says something like, I want to do something new. There's nothing new about that. He possibly calls it a disaster and says, he was right. I was wrong. The burping, I'm having difficulty with the question, what the hell did I do? Now, it seems to me equally plausible that the question, what the hell did I do, is referring to him taking the interview at all. When he says, he was right, I was wrong, even the filmmakers at the time said they believed he was referring to the decision to do the interview, which in a sense was something he sought out after the same team basically had done a fictionalized version of him with Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Durst that he had liked, and he had called them afterwards, and that's how they initially connected. So the question seems to have an answer, but the question was actually posed after the damning statement, or seemingly damning statement, killed them all, of course.
Well, can I tell you, this is stomach-dropping for someone who's made documentaries. I mean, your thoughts on this?
I personally think it's deeply problematic. I think that you want to be transparent with your viewers about what you're doing. Journalists have to shape narrative. You know, you're not simply laying out the raw material of your notebooks and your microphones and your tapes and simply saying to the listeners and the viewers and the readers, hey, you go figure it out. You're trying to shape a story. And sometimes that means you present things in a slightly different order than you might have received it. Mm-hmm. That's all well and good. In this case, by presenting a question and a seeming answer in close proximity that were actually inverted order, I think you're doing something deeply deceptive. It doesn't mean that they haven't compiled damning evidence. It doesn't mean the prosecutors don't have a damning evidence. But it does seem to me that it's not clear that the question, what the hell did I do, has any relationship to the phrase killed them all, of course. And I think there has to be transparency. And let me say a couple of other things. On the question of trust, that very audio of him going into the bathroom trying to regain his composure, his equipoise, they said, we didn't know about that audio for 2 years because right. people at the time of the release of that film said, why didn't we know about that? And they said, we didn't know about it because since that audio was him on a lavalier-like on a lapel of his jacket and we weren't following him in with a video camera, the audio wasn't associated with usable video. We didn't check it out for a couple years. An intern stumbled across it or something like that a couple years later. Maybe. But having that as an O. Henry-like reveal at the end of the documentary was something that raised a lot of red flags. They said if this was known, this should have been turned over to law enforcement a long time ago.
Exactly. I mean, it's hard to think, you know, you wouldn't just – that's the audio you would listen to, talking to himself behind a closed door. And then if you did know about it and held it for 2 years and didn't give it to the police, because L.A. police have indicated that evidence uncovered by the series is what led to the renewed interest in Susan Berman's murder.
Clearly, it was very closely linked to the timing of when they picked him up. They thought he might be on the run after this very damning final episode that was airing on HBO. So they snatched him up saying they believed they had indications that he might try to, as he had before, escape law enforcement in this case. And that's why they picked him up. Here's the funny thing. In terms of the question of whether or not they knew about that audio from 2 years earlier, it's a lot easier to credit somebody's explanation of something that's a little tough to swallow if you don't also now have an episode in which you think they were deceptive about how they presented things to you. I mean, we should be fair. You know, you've done documentaries. Mm. I've participated in them before. Mm. There's no board of review for documentaries. There's no controlling industry agency or government department that gets to say this is what you can do in a documentary and this is what you can't, right? So different documentary makers are going to have different codes of standards and of scruples. At NPR, we sometimes move around audio but say it has to be in exceptionally rigorous context and exceptionally fairly presented. I don't think you can make that case about what's happened here. This serves a larger narrative that they think they may have in terms of the truth of the story. They may feel that they have conclusively gathered evidence of his guilt, but that's different than saying they fairly presented the way in which his statements came out of his mouth.
Well, it sounds like there were about 20 lines. Maybe putting all of it in, you know, from behind a closed door might have also been powerful. Let other people figure out what the context is. It still is disturbing sound.
Oh, it's incredibly damning. It shows his confusion in some ways. It shows him grappling with questions of guilt and of trying to figure out what his role in his life has been. it's not super coherent. I totally agree with you. I mean, and that's also not as though HBO is, you know, like NBC having or CBS having to hit a sitcom perfectly after 30 minutes. A documentary on HBO has latitude in terms of how long it goes. They want to add an extra 20 seconds. That's fine. I also find it impossible to credit the explanation of Zach Stewart Pontier, one of the documentarians involved in this project, who basically said, hey, look, they're 10 seconds apart. The point at which in our presentation of the documentary, he says, what the hell do I do? And killed them all, of course. We didn't think people would link them or associate them. As a listener, a viewer, it's almost impossible not to link, killed them all, of course, not just link it to the question, but as an answer to the question. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's this line that Janet Malcolm uses to open the famous book, The Journalist and the Murderer. And she writes, every journalist who's not too stupid or too full of himself to notice what is going on knows that what he does is morally indefensible. And she continues, he's a kind of confidence man preying upon people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse. I don't believe that. I don't want to believe that. And I think that they may have felt that they were serving a higher truth, and that may blind them to the fact that there is a manipulation or seemingly, from my perspective, a deception going on here, even as the material they developed in the course of their documentary does seem quite damning.
And the prospect of seeing them on trial.
You know, look, I think right now Robert Durst has to address the fact that he's being tried in a murder out in California. And certainly his lawyers are going to try to make whatever hay they can out of this, suggesting a shadowy conspiracy between the documentary makers and law enforcement officials out in California. My guess is that this is certainly something useful to try to cast doubt on the credibility of the documentary makers. And their credibility may end up being an element of that trial and being, in fact, in a sense on trial. Haven't heard yet of any legal jeopardy they themselves would find themselves in.
NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you.
You bet.
And you might be wondering about using audio from someone who may not think they're being recorded. In some states, that is illegal. But at the time of the film, director Andrew Jarecki said that Durst signed a release in which he agreed we could use any recording of him in any way we deemed appropriate. He was well aware that he was mic'd, but the sound from the bathroom, was obviously a surprise, probably to both of us. Well, maybe more of a surprise to Durst, since we now know he didn't say what the filmmakers used.
A long-lost Philadelphia funk band recorded an album 50 years ago, but it was never released. The Nat Turner Rebellion broke up in the early 1970s. The studio session tapes for its debut album wound up in the Drexel University Audio Archive Library, where it was later rediscovered. The album was finally released last month. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports on the long, strange trip of the album Laugh to Keep from Crying.
In the late 1960s, Joe Jefferson of Petersburg, Virginia, was a drummer for hire, and he was good. He had a lot of work.
I need your sweet inspiration.
He was touring with Sissy Houston and her band, The Sweet Inspirations, but got waylaid in Philadelphia with a foot infection. While recuperating, he had a revelation. He didn't want to play R&B anymore.
Got tired of doing that. Tired. I just got tired of beating somebody else's drum. You know what I'm saying? I wanted to beat my own drum. I knew I had something. It's now or never. Either I'm going to put this thing together or I'm never going to do it. And that's what I did. Basically, I went back home, went back to Petersburg, put together Nat Turner Rebellion. Vocally, The Temptation. As a rock band, The Stones did it for me. I was a Stone fanatic. But the soul of Nat Turner Rebellion, if there was anybody, it would be Sly and the Family Stone. You know, we wanted to be Sly. Didn't everybody?
The Nat Turner Rebellion, named after a black slave uprising in 1831 that killed over 50 white people, was a blistering live act that toured the East Coast from Florida to Montreal.
We were crowd killers. You know, you come to see one of our shows, you never forget the band.
After proving themselves on the road, it was time to put it down on wax. In 1969, Jefferson and the Nat Turner Rebellion signed with Stan Watson of Philly Groove Records and started to record an album in studio. That's where the trouble started. Watson had already scored a huge hit with the Delphonics, who put out smooth, sweet R&B like La La Means I Love You.
La 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 la.
Watson wanted to replicate that formula with the Nat Turner Rebellion.
He really had an eye for talent. The problem was he didn't know what to do with the people after he got them. That was kind of like where we were.
The album was recorded at Sigma Sound Studios in Philadelphia, but never released. The band had its own internal problems and fell apart. The tapes stayed on the shelf for 30 years until Sigma Sound shut down, and all of its tapes were shipped across town to the audio archive at Drexel University. There, they sat for another 10 years until they were discovered by Faith Newman of Reservoir Media. She had bought the rights to the entire Philly Groove Records catalog. Newman really didn't know completely what she had bought. She remembered rummaging around in boxes of old publicity material.
The pictures caught my eye. Had big afros, and they were fists raised in the air, and, you know, and all these other really very groovy pictures that they had.
Newman was expecting to find more of that sweet R&B sound, like the Delphonics.
But the Nat Turner Rebellion stood out, and the first song that I heard was called Tribute to a Slave.
There was enough material on those Nat Turner Rebellion tapes for a full-length release, and perhaps more importantly, they had a story to tell, one never heard before. A funk band from the 1970s named after a 19th century slave rebellion, singing songs like Tribute to a Slave.
With all that's going on right now with race relations in this country being what they are, the Black Lives Matter movement, I mean, I feel like the messages in those songs are still relevant today.
None of the members of the Nat Turner Rebellion are alive anymore except Joe Jefferson. He sits at the kitchen table of his spacious, comfortable home in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, the last man standing. Jefferson has mixed feelings about this record. For one thing, he says the Nat Turner Rebellion was best as a live act. The studio recordings could not capture what they did on stage.
I'm not unhappy about this album. I'm very happy about this album. I guess the thing that I'm most unhappy about is that my guys are not here.
The Nat Turner Rebellion's debut album, recorded 50 years ago, was called Laugh to Keep from Crying. It was released as a download through Drexel University's Mad Dragon label. 5,000 copies of a vinyl issue sold out immediately. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Crimmins.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young, and they sound great. Yeah. This is Here and Now.
She had nobody looking at me.